Please listen carefully.
The act of taking a thought from my head and putting it into your head.
Communication to me is everything. It's the strongest way for two people to convey information to each other.
Bridging what I have in my head to the outside world.
Open conversation with another person.
I think it's the ability to share your innermost feelings and thoughts with others.
Communication is the way that people interact with others, no matter what modality it may be.
Welcome to the SpeechScience.org podcast, episode number 2. My name is Matthew Hott, alongside Lucas Stuber.
Hey, everyone.
Ivan Campos.
Hey, what's up?
And located in Central Time Zone, Chandru Vittal.
Hi, everyone. How are you doing?
How are you gentlemen doing? Episode number 2, the first time the four of us are together. How are you guys doing?
Pretty great. Hey,
pretty well.
Awesome.
It was real cool to see how well, the first podcast and content was adopted by the community. So very thankful for that.
And since this is the first time that the four of us are really getting together, let's take a little bit of time here to introduce ourselves. Ivan, we're going to start with you. Who are you? Where are you from? Give us the hot details.
So I live in Southern California, and I am a speech pathologist. I am completing my CF clinical fellowship year. I came into the field of speech language pathology by, I guess, working in the migrant education program in Southern Virginia, rural Virginia, where I would go into homes and provide interpretation services for early intervention. And so this is a third career for me, and I'm really excited about the field. And currently my caseload, I work in the public schools. I work with special education preschoolers, mild to severe disabilities, and also in a subacute, acute pediatric rehab. So that's a little bit about me. I'm interested in bilingual, multiculturalism, and diversity issues that affect our profession.
Pretty awesome. Chandru, what brings you to our field of speech and language pathology? You're our resident student of the foursome right now.
Oh, yeah. So I actually discovered speech pathology sort of by accident. I took a introductory linguistics course as an engineering major and fell in love with the field. Then I started observing, speech therapists. Actually, I even observed my own speech therapist, so really interesting to see it on the other side. And really fell in love with the field and decided to try to break in. I found actually pretty difficult to get in because my university didn't really offer many courses or many information on that. So I actually, that's when I met Lucas. He had a bunch of things on his website all about the new research issues facing speech language pathologists. I used those to help me get into grad school. That's how I met him. And that's how I met you guys as well, too.
Awesome.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome. And yeah, as Matt was saying, I'm the resident student. I have just about 3 more months left in my program. Then I will start being a CF back in my hometown in Northern California. And so my research interests are those issues facing new clinicians and also issues facing minority speech language pathologists.
I guess that's a pretty good transition into you, Lucas, our farthest west, I think, of the four of us.
I think so, out here in Oregon, kind of right on the, so Portland, Oregon, right on the border with Washington. My name is Lucas Stuber. I've been really fascinated by language and also really fascinated by technology for a long time. So my initial undergrad course was computer science, focusing on computer programming. And then took an etymology course, actually, and I was like, I kind of like learning about languages more. I still like the math side. So I got a master's in applied linguistics and studied the disordered language that occurs in individuals diagnosed with schizophrenia for a number of years. Some stuff came out of that. And, the more I did that, the more I sat in sort of like a basement office doing research and listening to transcripts. I was like, I want to get out into the field. So went back and became a speech language pathologist. Let's see. So what do I do? I'm kind of a serial starter of things, I guess, is what I would call it. I think for a lot of people that work in a service profession or really enjoy their job, it doesn't feel like a job to me. And so, folks will say things like, you don't want to bring your work home with you. Well, I sort of inevitably do, and I don't regret it. I'm always sort of thinking about things related to the people I serve. So I do a lot of writing, in that regard. So I used to have this blog called This Month in Speech Science, which was pretty popular. I'm really flattered and blown away that that's Chandra. That's, you know, your introduction. Really, we can thank him for this website, because him getting in touch with me about that made me think, you know, why did I stop doing that? We really need we need more resources out there in the field. And then I also I work as an ASC specialist pretty much exclusively, generally with what we would call low incidence disorders, so kind of rare genetic stuff, pretty much birth, you know, the whole span of life, but with a focus on pediatrics. And in the course of that work, I helped to make an app called Free Speech, which got pretty popular, and happy to share more about that. I'm not selling anything. We don't sell things on this. But we won Best of CES Asia in our category and some other things, so that was really flattering. My motivation then to sort of start back up, I already shared a little bit of it, but I really strongly believe that one of the reasons there are misconceptions out there in the world about things like what we do, but then on a broader sense, things like autism spectrum disorder and, you know, a lot of misunderstanding. But I think part of the issue is that we've sort of let the snake oil salesman take the microphone, if that makes any sense. And I believe that we need really accessible, evidence-based materials that are available out there that, you know, maybe aren't always just for SLPs, but also for parents and for educators and people that don't have the time or the training to read the primary research. I just think that's something that needs to exist in a whole variety of fields. So this is, you know, I guess our humble contribution to that goal.
I think it's kind of interesting that the four of us all kind of came to this as either by accident or through a second career. Myself, I worked at a radio station in the southern tier of New York. I worked at a TV and a radio station, I should say. And it was Christmas Day. I had to work at the TV station from 4 a.m. to 10 a.m., from the radio station from 11 a.m. till 3 p.m., and then back at the TV station from 4 p.m. till midnight on Christmas. And I'm hitting the space bar, and I thought, is there something I could be doing that gives back a little bit to the community, give back to somebody? And one of my reporters, she was a speech and language pathologist, and her and I had talked a little bit about it, and she said, oh yeah, I get to work in a hospital with kids every Saturday morning, you know, make a little extra cash, and I get to be a reporter on the side. And I looked into it, left my original career, told my girlfriend, which is now my wife, and said, hey, this is your out if you want to. I'm quitting my career. I'm going back to grad school. And what is it, 6 years later, here I am as the speech and language pathologist at a high school down here in Cincinnati and doing home health care. It's pretty interesting that the four of us all kind of have differing backgrounds and find ourselves right back here. And that kind of brings it to this website. What are your guys' intentions, goals, dreams for speechscience.org?
I really want this podcast to be sort of a venue for continuing education. I feel like once I leave grad school, there's going to be no one saying, oh, when you get this client, do this. So I really feel like I really want this to be a venue where I can learn and then hopefully teach people if I can learn adequately. Hopefully learn and teach basically what are the new things that are going on in the field, what should we be doing, and basically how is this field going. I know there's also some other things I want to do. I really want to start reviewing the latest research and interviewing the professors there, getting to know their insights, getting to see where they come from, seeing what the people in academia would like to see us clinicians on the ground do. I also know, I was talking with Lucas about this sort of at the beginning, we could talk about what is new going on in our kids' lives. One of the quotes that he has that I'm going to frame on my wall when I get a speech room finally is, if you want to perform adequate therapy for an 11-year-old, you should think like one. I think personally, since I'm as mature as one, it's very easy for me to do so. But it still, I think, requires a lot of thinking. It still requires a lot of being in someone else's shoes. So I wanted to talk a little bit about sort of what are the new trends that the youth are doing today, so that we can be with it, if you will.
Lucas, you have the coolest collection of Lego watches, and you were retweeted by Lego. Is that right?
Yeah, Lego is actually Lego has shared a fair amount of my stuff in the past. at some point on the website, I'll put up some embarrassing pictures of how much Lego I have. But, you know, I have a rule that I always want to wear two things that can start a conversation with a student, right? And so usually that's a Lego watch or something ridiculous. And then I always mismatch my socks. And there's a lot of – this was taught to me by an 82-year-old retired SLP. And it works like a charm. It always gets kids interested. If nothing else, it'll amuse some of the kids that I work with that are really medically fragile. But yeah, that was pretty funny to see Lego so happy with it. But Lego being used in therapy, actually, by the way, hey, and I'm just saying this not to defend myself. I sound defensive. There's research that's been done on Lego-based therapy in our field specifically. And one of the authors of the main book is Simon Baron Cohen himself, who is, you know, one of the originators of the concept of theory of mind, and also
Sacha Baron Cohen's cousin as well, which I think is
also
amazing.
His cousin, yes. Wow. Borat's cousin, so small world. Yeah, I've got a Lego thing. Let me address the question of the website then. There is so much bad information out there, I guess I would say, particularly available to parents, to paraeducators, to educators. And we as SLPs so often are just kind of like islands unto ourselves after graduation, right? You know? So it's important, I think, to do networking and those sorts of things to keep going. And obviously important to do continuing education. But I have had this dream for a long time of really fun, engaging, free materials out there that are accessible to anyone, right? So that parents can understand them, they can be shared, they can be printed out and handed to all the IAs in the school. And then it's really for two reasons. It's one, because people may not have the time or the, you know, proficiency to read all the primary research, but also with sort of a problem, which is that it takes 7 years of education, right? Or 6 years and then a CF and then a journal membership to really access the research in our field. And I think when you build the walls of your ivory tower that thick, you know, it's kind of – no wonder the snake oil salesmen are going to set up shop outside. So I kind of want to take back control of the microphone around our field specifically, but also some things conceptually. And I've tried to do this. I do have a website that offers a similar purpose that's specific to augmented communication, but really what I've wanted to do is do it all. So we've structured this kind of in a way where we're covering all the SIGs, right, with the special interest groups of ASHA as well as a few other things. I'm just excited. I can't believe the team that came together. And I thank Chandra for coming to me and telling the story about having read this blog that I wrote for a few years called Speech Science, or this month in Speech Science. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's how we got our name. It was my way just to make sure that I was critically analyzing the literature, right? So anything that I felt capable of really analyzing, I'd write a summary of it that was very brief and then throw them up online. And I knew people were reading it, but I'd never sort of met anyone that had. So,
well, thanks for writing it. All I did was the easy part. I just read them. I mean, you did the hard part of, like, writing them.
I'm a huge nerd, obviously, but I think it's fun.
Yeah.
I like reading, reading the research and then knowing that you're – a service. I mean, that's huge. So it improved my understanding of what I was reading, and it also helped me stay up, you know, in my own practice on everything. And I still read the research. I just haven't been doing that for a while, and I'm not really sure why I stopped. So I guess you motivated me, and I'm like, all right, we got such a cool group of people. Let's do this. Let's make the podcast. Let's make the website. Because SLPs are in their cars a lot. And SLPs are looking online a lot. So.
And thinking of the website, right now on speechscience.org, you can log on at home, check out a current app review for the Super Duper Data Tracker, and from Ivan Campos, a kind of an introduction to cultural and linguistic diversity, right?
Most definitely, yes. I think that when we think about speech language pathology and even audiology, there is a huge gender a huge gender difference.
Aphasia, Ivan, is what you're looking at right now.
You know, and I'm still looking for that word. You know, there's a huge gender gap. Maybe that's the correct word. Between males and females in this profession, I believe it's there are out of 165,000 speech-language pathologists that are members of ASHA. Just going off the top of my head, I believe it's about 3.7% that are identify as male. And, you know, if you think about the population of the United States, it's 50% male approximately. And so I think for us to be able to provide more equitable or even more, you know, services to our diverse populations that we serve, I think males need to join this wonderful, amazing profession like each of us here have as a, you know, as a opportunity from a different field that we were in before. And so the article that I wrote addresses some issues with also the lack of diversity, meaning in addition to males, also minorities in the field. I believe off the top of my head, the figures that I remember writing about, that there are about 11% bilingual speech language pathologists in the United States. Compared to maybe the population where there's about 26% that identify as having a second language at home or a primary language other than English. And so I believe that as America is becoming more and more of a, you know, the familiar phrase, your melting pot, but also a land of immigrants, that the diversity within ASHA also has to increase in order for us to be able to serve those groups of people from different languages, people groups, ethnicities, cultures, because as you work with an African-American client, as you work with a Caucasian client, as you work with a Hispanic client, an Indian family, you know, an Asian family, an African family, we are treating, yes, the same, perhaps the same ideologies, or perhaps treating the same language issues, articulation issues, voice issues. However, one must be adept at reaching that person in their culture and having at least some basic information. And I know for me growing up in Southern California, especially my parents who were immigrants here from Mexico, they would always ask somebody, do you speak Spanish? You know, they felt more comfortable talking to a doctor in Spanish, talking to a professional in Spanish. And, you know, it'd be really great if the membership of SLPs in ASHA, there can be this wave of minority SLPs, a wave of more male speech language pathologists to be able to really, you know, reach these different populations in our country that maybe perhaps are not always seeking services or feel comfortable reaching out for services. So it's a really nice article, I think, that addressed also what can we do as speech language pathologists to address these issues. What can we do in our communities? What can we do in our jobs? And I think mentoring is a great thing to do. Mentoring out to minorities, you know, tell us about the field. That's how I became involved in this field, because somebody told me about it. And so I think that if we take this opportunity to become ambassadors for our profession, and I think, you know what, it boils down to that people don't really know what speech pathologists do. Would you guys agree with that?
Yeah,
there's
for sure.
Exactly.
There's this huge misconception as you guys work on articulation, right? Or stuttering, right?
But there's when people ask me what I do at family gatherings, I'm always like, here we go.
Now, Ivan, as the bilingual SLP of the group, I'm going to ask you a question. And it's a question I've always wanted to ask a bilingual SLP. So first I should ask, is English or Spanish your first language?
Actually, Spanish.
So when you're, so I guess when you're working with a student in English, do you have to, in your brain, do you have to almost think back into Spanish to translate back into English, or do you just kind of quickly, like a snap of the finger, can go into English? Because my second language is German, and it takes me a good 10 to 15 minutes to come up with the sentence for where the bathroom is, let alone do therapy in it.
You know, I really don't, I don't even notice the switch, to be honest. I grew up speaking Spanish until I was 5 years old, and then my parents realized that, wait, you need to go to kindergarten. so then it was in kindergarten where I actually began to learn English. And so I was in a bilingual, this was back in California, back in the 80s, mid-80s, where bilingual education was still part of the California educational landscape. it's come back now, but for a while it was gone. Mm-hmm. And so I spent 3 years in a bilingual classroom where instruction was in Spanish and English, a hybrid of both. And then eventually I transitioned over to English only in, I think, the third grade, if I recall correctly. But to answer your question, you know, if I know I'm going to do an English assessment, my brain is on English.
Okay.
If I know I'm going to work with a Spanish-only patient or client, then my brain is in Spanish. However, many of the quote-unquote Spanish assessments that I do in schools are actually bilingual assessments.
Oh.
We're looking at language across different buckets of language. You know, if you think about language as water, and then you have a bucket for Spanish water, a bucket for English water. And so when I give a Spanish assessment, they're usually bilingual. And so I will assess in Spanish. I will give the student an opportunity to respond in Spanish. And if they don't know the answer in Spanish, then I say, well, then I ask them to prompt in English. And so on many assessments, the answers are correct as long as you get an answer in English or Spanish. And so I don't necessarily think about my brain switching. However, when I lived in Virginia for 7 years there, and there were very few Spanish-speaking individuals there, then there were times where I didn't speak to anybody speaking Spanish for a few days. I would notice that I would have to get back into that, okay, now we're in Spanish, like maybe you mentioned with the German. So assessing bilinguals is very interesting because you're analyzing everything in two languages at the same time. You're trying to process, okay, they know this in Spanish, but then they're responding to me in English. So what's going on here? And many times when I get called in to do a bilingual assessment, it's more for a differential diagnosis to determine, is this really a true language disorder, or is this just a part of a student in an English classroom learning English? That's why they're having difficulty acquiring language. So I hope I've answered your question.
That is the coolest thing I have ever heard. And I say that just from the English-speaking one-language SLP.
That's neat to hear about. Well, and, you know, from my end, working with the really impacted students who are often using AAC, I can't tell you how many times – because I'm in private practice, right, and I do a lot of traveling because I live in Oregon, right? And a lot of the kids that I see are medically fragile, and they'll just be at home a lot of the time. So, I probably drive 200 miles a day. But in those situations, I very frequently will have Spanish L1 students that are, you know, again, pretty impacted. And it's interesting to watch in classrooms where the teachers will be giving instructions in English. They're saying, oh, he's non-compliant or he doesn't understand. And then you ask the same question in Spanish and immediately he gets it. Just for some reason, people don't think about it. So I know, Ivan, you're really looking forward to sharing more about bilingualism and diversity in general. I'm looking forward to talking a lot about international stuff. So next week, the podcast that we have is going to focus on an interview that I had with a gentleman who's aspiring to be an SLP in Iraq. And in the future, that's a theme that I want to explore a fair amount, having done a lot of work in India and presenting in Pakistan and a couple countries in Southeast Africa. SLP culture is very, very different around the world. There's a lot fewer SLPs out there than there are here, for sure. I also want to say something really quickly just to folks that are out there listening. You know, we interviewed Mike last week from ASHA, and the context of that was specifically about driving in, you know, enrollment in ASHA, particularly in the case of men. So that's there is a little bit of irony or something that you know, the site that we were making or that we've made was driven by a group of friends that met. They were all male. But if you're listening to this, please know that this content in speech science is also for women, right? Obviously, it's a tool for the whole community. And if you're interested in contributing, please contact us because we want to have as many voices heard as possible.
And that contact information is contact@speechscience.org, or you can call us at area code 503-345-6740. Leave a voicemail with your contact information, and one of the four of us should get back to you some relatively quickly, right?
Yeah, I think email might be a little quicker, but hey, we got a phone number. Cool.
So changing gears just a little bit, gentlemen. Any fun therapy stories this week? HIPAA compliant. I'll start. Actually, today when we recorded this, it was our district-wide fishing trip. Normally, we actually go to a lake, and all the teachers are on high alert to make sure no one ends up in the lake. This year, no students ended up in the lake because it rained, so we had it in the gym. The local news showed up, and there's nothing quite like seeing grades preschool all the way through our 12th or 23rd graders laughing, smiling, and goofing around in a gym. So the end of the year is the best time to be a school speech pathologist because you get to see the kids doing a couple fun things.
See, I didn't realize you were being serious when you said you had a school fishing trip in the gym.
We did! Everyone wore their fishing shirts. Their little,
I thought that was just kind of like a thing you do in Ohio.
We all go down to the river and fish.
Maybe think of that.
The river that runs through our gym, yeah.
The Netflix show Stranger Things. They got the pool and they kind of freak me out there. What do I have from this week? Jeez. Well, I totaled my car driving. So that's a fun story. Driving to one of those clients. What else? That can't be a good story. I think my favorite one was, one thing when we're working with emergent language, with augmented communication is, trying to increase the mean length of utterance, right? So, going from one word to two words to three words and trying to expand outside of just a requesting or system to commenting and these other things. And, I had a student that has just really struggled, for a variety of reasons, say on his device, because I could tell he was a little done with me for the day, and he said ugly Luke butt, and which was the first time he'd used three words together, and it was a comment, and it was a refusal kind of too at the same time, and so I was like, I'll take it.
Well, that's awesome. That's gonna be a curse sometime. Yeah, watch, like, Dungeons and Dragons, or yeah, that'll be the next curse.
I gave a kid an AAC device a couple years ago. Sorry, Chandra. And yep, the first thing he did was open the keyboard and typed out F-U-C, and the teacher runs over, and she's like, he can't say that. I was like, he's a teenager and wants to play with curse words. It's pretty much appropriate.
Happens.
I think I've had a very interesting week with assessments this week. I am in the process of assessing an older student in a public school that has a degenerative neurological condition. And so as part of the assessment, there is some dysarthria that is occurring. Sorry, as part of the degenerative process, there's some dysarthria that is noticeable now. And so as I'm given an articulation assessment, I'm thinking to myself, wait, something just doesn't sound right. I can hear the sounds, I can hear the right phonemes, but there's something different here. And so I'm sitting there and I'm thinking back to my motor speech class, which I'm sure you guys all remember and memorized every type of dysarthria there is, right?
Flaccid, spastic, ataxic.
I carry a reference.
And so it's like, how do I assess this? Do I need to refer out? Do I need to, what is the educational, what type of educational assessment can I do for this dysarthria? And so lo and behold, I found my Joe Duffy book on motor speech disorders. And there we were, myself with along with another speech pathologist, we were doing dialectokinetic rates to determine, is there, any impairment in that area, also breath support. And so I just found it so fascinating that many times there's this misconception that, oh, you're going to work in the schools and all you're going to do is artic, maybe some fluency, maybe some pragmatics. And lo and behold, here I'm doing in my first year out from grad school a motor speech assessment. And I thought that was really, I was just tickled to death over it, So I just found it very neat that I had this opportunity. And it'll be interesting to see to figure out, what type of services are provided based from the recommendations from the assessment. So I've had this amazing opportunity. I think there's this misconception that once you start working in the public schools that you're not going to work with maybe students that are medically fragile or students that have, very unique presentations in terms of language and voice. And I feel that, just this past experience with the opportunity to assess a student's motor speech ability, I think that is show me that those skills that we learned in grad school, which were very broad and perhaps not very deep, in terms of assessment at times. And I just found it very, very fulfilling to be able to serve this student than, you know, the student's needs. And we're still in the process of completing the assessment, and I'm just very curious to see, you know, how in the public schools we'd be able to address the issue of dysarthria. And because we're looking, you know, is this dysarthria impacting the student's academic ability or ability to participate in academics? And so I'm just very excited about it. So
very nice. Chandra, how was your week going on, my man?
My week is going pretty good. It's my last week of my school placement. So now I am, in theory, qualified to work on this in a school of my own. I'm still very terrified about that. So I was listening to some videos by this YouTuber who does nothing related to speech pathology, science-related videos. His name is CGP Gray. He talks all about science and economics and technology. He's really cool. I recommend you guys check him out. What I was really noticing while he does his videos, the CGP Gray guy, what he tends to do is he tends to use an interesting speech strategy. He slows down his rate of speech. He slows down his rate of speech at the end of a sentence. So basically, if he's going to talk, his speech would sound like this. And I have some fluency kids who sound very disfluent towards the end of the sentence. So I actually told them, hey, you start using this strategy as well. And it seemed to work actually pretty well. I thought it was pretty awesome. I emailed just telling them, hey, this famous YouTuber who they've actually seen before is doing the speech strategy. And it really shows me that you can use real-world speech strategies in practice. And it really helps, at least for the older kids, to see, hey, you know, quote-unquote, normal, mainstream people are using speech strategies as well. And it really shows that, you know, being in speech is not like some kind of disability. It's basically everyone has issues in communication at times. We just telling people how to make it better.
Very cool.
Yeah, that's awesome. I really love that message. That's something I like to hammer home is, you know, especially in the world of AAC, like people will say like, oh, well, he doesn't need his device to be with him right now. You know, we're going to the park or something. And I always want to say, okay, well, then take off your shoes and walk to the park because it's legitimately a prosthetic as anything else. Mm-hmm. Or your glasses. And so that's cool. I like that. We're all, everybody's got something going on. I was a clutterer, and I still sometimes do when I get excited. I just want to say one last thing, which is I just think it's cool the diversity of people that are here today. You know, I mean, I think we all represent different phases of being in the work process, and also, you know, a range of settings, a range of interests, and so that's it reflects the many, many directions that you can go in this field.
And this week, Chandra, you had the opportunity to talk to Dr. Taub and Dr. Aswadi. What is the vow? Give us a little bit of background about what today's main interview is about.
What they're talking about is about generalization. So this is a skill that I think we work on a lot. We see, for example, our kids doing stuff really well in the therapy room, but then the minute they walk outside, like the classroom teacher, they're not going to use not using what their skills they've learned. Same with the phasia therapy too. You know, our clients will be using they'll be sounding much better in the therapy room, but when they leave and then their home setting, in whatever social settings, whatever settings they're in, they're not using their skills. So how do we make sure that their patients are using these skills that they're learning when they leave us and are in the real world? Edward Taub and Jitendra Aswadi are two of the co-authors of a study that examines this question. They've developed an assessment called the Verbal Activity Log, or VAL. And the VAL is a way that the patient and caregiver can basically fill out what they are doing, how the patient themselves, if they're filling it out themselves, is what sort of language they're using and how often they're using it. And they also correlated this with their, this is a spoiler, sorry, but they correlated the measures of the VAL when they actually had their patients wear a tape recorder, an audio recorder around with them. So they were able to compare how they scored with how much they're actually talking. And it actually correlates pretty well.
And that interview will be right after this. You're listening to the SpeechScience.org podcast.
I'm Paul George of the Indiana Pacers. When I was six, my days were spent playing basketball. When I was six, my dream was to make it to the NBA. When I was six, my mom had a stroke. So I want you to learn to spot a stroke fast. F-A-S-T. F, face drooping. A, arm weakness. S, speech difficulty. T, time to call 911. I'm Paul George. Spot a stroke fast. Visit strokeassociation.org. Brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
Can you tell me a little bit about what the VAL is?
It's a structured interview that compares the current amount and quality of spoken language in a variety of behaviorally distinct real-life situations with these characteristics prior to disease onset. The key phrase is that it is a behaviorally based instrument, so that it was designed to evaluate the effects of CI aphasia therapy 2, which is a behaviorally based intervention, and the VAL is a designed to evaluate the effects, the behavioral effects of a behavioral intervention. Obviously, it's a behavioral intervention with respect to language, but spoken language, and it does not dip into, doesn't tap into other forms of communication, like a gesture or facial grimaces or pointing. Any compensatory means of communication is excluded.
The motivation for this kind of measure that focuses on amount of speech in everyday life outside of the treatment setting, it derives from work that Ed did with the African monkeys some time back.
The monkeys don't talk.
Yes. So
they communicate.
And it relates to the idea of learn non-use. This work was first done in monkeys with a deactivated forelimb and then applied to stroke patients with upper extremity hemiparesis. And in the patients with upper extremity hemiparesis, what we found is that there is, in many cases, a substantial difference between how much and how well they use their more affected arm in the everyday setting and then what they do when you ask them to use that arm in the laboratory. So often patients will use that arm when you ask them to in the laboratory setting, but then if you question them about what they're doing at home, they're using that arm very little or not at all. And you have a parallel phenomenon in people with aphasia, where on a laboratory test, they may be able to produce speech, but if you question them or examine how much they're actually speaking at home, they're speaking very little.
And the one other consideration that should be made about the VAL is that in the paper that we've published about it, we've also validated or studied another measure, which is a audio recording, which is an objective audio recording of the speech that people produce in the life situation, based on recordings made from a recorder worn in a person's clothing. We take a random sample or a random sample of segments of the speech during an extended period of time over the course of a day, or it could be 2 days. And we've compared the results in the VAL, which is a structured interview, which is answered jointly, or it's answered by a patient and confirmed by a caregiver. And we've compared that to the results for the audio recording, and they're very highly correlated.
Do you feel that the recorder accurately captured patients' conversations?
Our experience is that, you know, when you record continuously like that, people get accustomed fairly quickly to wearing a sensor. They forget they're wearing a sensor.
Right. And there is a cross-validation between the two measures, the audio recording and the VAL. And if there were some sensitivity in the audio recording, it probably wouldn't show up as being as highly correlated.
How did he become interested in studying aphasia therapy?
It occurred to us that language, or spoken language, was no less of a response than a movement of the hand, than a key press or a ball press. It has its own characteristics, naturally. There's a difference between manual dexterity and the linguistic content of an utterance. Nevertheless, looking at it abstractly, there are aspects of spoken language that are similar to a response by hand. And so our hypothesis was that language could be manipulated in the same way that movements of an extremity could be, and that this could be used as a therapeutic tool for improving paired function, whether it be the function of a hand or language function. Now, that started out as a hypothesis. We didn't assert that it was the case. We thought that it was possible that it was the case, and so that we undertook the CI Aphasia Therapy 1 studies that I stimulated and carried out in collaboration with Friedemann Pulvermüller in Germany to test that possibility. I had been working for 4 years with the head of their department, Dr. Thomas Elbert, and I have been trying to convince Thomas to start trying to work with language with CI therapy principles. We had a number of grants, and our plate was full here at UAB, and I thought that they had a connection with Schmiede Clinic, a treatment of aphasia, and they were well set up to work with this. But I was only there for 2 weeks, twice a year, for a period of years, and so I wasn't able to oversee what was happening. And what we wound up with was a single exercise based on Friedemann Pulvermüller's earlier language games, which were based on Wittgenstein's original language games. Wittgenstein was the leader of the Vienna Circle and was a distinguished logical positivist, and logical positivists were interested in language. Friedemann Pulvermüller took Wittgenstein's language games, modified it, and published two papers with an investigator named Schoenle in 1990, and it had a modest effect. When we applied CI therapy principles to it, it had a much, much larger effect, but the treatment effect was much smaller than we were getting with movement. And it was only a single exercise with CI therapy. We used a variety of different exercises. And with CI therapy, we used movement therapy. We used what we call the transfer package to facilitate transfer of what a person did in the treatment setting into the life setting, and with the recognition that what happened in the life setting was all important. What was happening in the treatment setting was of interest, and that is what almost all therapeutic interventions focused on. But with respect to the person's quality of life, what was important was not what they were doing in the treatment setting, but what they were doing in the life situation. And if what they were doing in the treatment setting didn't transfer, you're not really in the rehabilitation business. I mean, one might say so what? So you've got an improved response or linguistic formulation in the laboratory. But if they can't do that to talk to people out in their everyday life situations, one might ask, so what? So to speak. We recognize that that is not a traditional point of view, but that is the point of view that we came into the speech-language field with. When I got back to UAB, we worked with an investigator named Margaret Johnson and Leslie Parker and others, Michelle Haddad in particular, and we fully translated or attempted to more fully translate the CI movement therapy protocol to a language setting. And we did a variety of things, which is described in the paper that we published, the pilot study that we published in the area. We used a large variety of exercises, but we used a transfer package so that we trained the caregiver to promote language on the part of the caregiver, and in particular, to not speak for the patient. That is been written about in two papers by Croteau, and it is much more common than is taken into consideration in the SLP literature, because the caregiver, either because they're very sympathetic to a struggling patient, or they get very impatient with the halting expression of the patient, they take over the conversation and the patient comes to depend on that. As a result, the caregiver frequently, for the best of reasons, winds up suppressing the spontaneous speech of the patient. So we train the caregiver, it's a very hard habit to break, not to speak for the patient, and to carry out a number of mechanisms for promoting spontaneous speech in the home situation. We do a variety of other things to affect that transfer. And when you do that, what you get is a treatment effect that is, after 3 weeks, a 300% improvement in the amount of spoken language. And we haven't published this yet, but we started out with two patients who had very impaired language. At the end of 3 weeks of therapy, they had the standard 300% improvement, which left them about at a 55% amount of speech compared to before stroke. But then we had the caregiver working with them over the next 2 years, and we followed the patients. And at the end of 2 years, both patients had gotten very close to normal speech. 4.8 and 4.9 out of the 5-point scale of the VAL.
Well, one thing that you can't overemphasize is the importance of the transfer package elements that Ed was mentioning. Coming from a psychology background, they are very, so to speak, natural for us, but for scientists and therapists from other disciplines, I think they're a little unfamiliar. In motor therapy, we found that if you give CI therapy without the transfer package elements, you get about half of the impact on real-world use of the more affected arm. And we've also found in that same study that it is those elements, the transfer package elements, that are responsible for producing the large widespread structural changes that we have observed in the brain after CI motor therapy.
What advice would you give to clinicians and therapists, especially if they work with patients with aphasia?
I think we would, emphasize the value of these behavioral components that help to transfer gains from the treatment setting to the real world. That's with respect to therapy. With respect to assessment, again, emphasize, look at what's going on outside of the treatment setting. And the other thing which we've encountered, which has been an issue for us with respect to CI movement therapy, is to stress the importance of testing and doing the therapy completely as it's described. Because what we've experienced with the dissemination of CI movement therapy is folks have been eager to tinker with it and add on parts or take away parts, and haven't really followed the published treatment protocol with great fidelity. And as a result, in the literature, what you see a lot of papers that are titled and described as doing CI movement therapy, but they get half or less the results that we do, but they are treated as CI therapy papers because that's how they're titled, but the protocol is not faithful to CI therapy.
Differences, they do not use the elements of the transfer package. We describe them, but they're transparent to physical and occupational therapists. And I suspect that they will also be transparent to SLPs because it's not in their training. And so we describe them, but then people don't employ them because they don't view them as terribly important. They view other aspects of our protocol as central, and it's difficult to overemphasize the importance of the transfer package for producing an effect in the real world.
Dr. Taub and Dr. Uswate, thank you so much for joining us.
Welcome back to the SpeechScience.org podcast. I'm Matt Hodd alongside Lucas, Ivan, and Chandru. Chandru, great job grabbing those guys for our website. Well done, sir. Something we didn't touch on real quick. How did the four of us really get to know each other?
What was it? It was, Chandru, you read stuff years ago, actually. That would have been quite a while.
Yeah, 2014. I remember that summer when I was like, oh, I should probably start looking at applying to grad school now. And I was in that panic, and I contacted you, and you were like, don't panic.
Lucas, I think I met you at the inaugural all-gentlemen, all-guy speech meeting at the brewery in Denver where there were six of us.
Yeah, I think you're right. And then I ran into you all over Asha after that, I remember.
I just remember that big purple bear in the lobby outside the elevator.
I forgot about that. You mean nightmares.
Is that the bear that was trying to break into the convention center? That's a weird sculpture, I guess, piece of art.
Denver, get a better bear for your convention center. I can't say. The convention center down here in Cincinnati used to have a big art piece of a wrench.
What was the one? Was it this past, Asher, where there was the big horse thing outside? I don't know.
No,
well, the next one's in L.A.
That's
Ivan's hometown, so maybe you should tell us what kind of bear suit are you going to wear to Asher?
A super duper bear? Oh. How about I dress up as the super duper zebra?
So, Ivan, how did you find us?
If you're listening, we gotta have him do it.
Yeah, now the whole world knows.
And then I think we met also through the group, right?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, okay.
I think I'm not sure how I found the league, but the league found me.
Yeah, I didn't choose the league life.
And then we had a league meetup up in Philadelphia, and I think that's how we all connected.
And that league is the League of Extraordinary Speech Gentlemen. Open to anyone identifying as male and also undergrad, graduate, and currently working as a speech
or language pathologist.
You just got to be a speech person, yep. Or an audiologist.
You can find us on Facebook.
Yeah, Facebook.com.
Yep. So the group's on Facebook, or you can also go to theleagueofgents.com. It'll direct you to our various things.
All right, gentlemen, let's do some what they call on the radio forward selling on speechscience.org. This week, I've got a review of the Super Duper Data Pro app that's coming up this week. Gentlemen, what do you guys have coming up?
If you're not already tired of hearing my voice and you want to read what I have to say, I will have a summary of the Taub and Uswathe, actually the head editor article on the VAL.
I also have a transcript summary of the interview that Lucas Stuber and I did with Mike Sciatos from ASHA Membership Director, where we addressed issues of diversity, male recruitment, and future membership growth for ASHA.
Yeah, and I'm going to be adding, I have a large body of sort of past writing, which is nice to have, and it's been kind of fun over the years to do a lot of writing and then to be like Ash has published one of my things and I don't know, he gets published. But anyway, I'm going to be migrating a lot of that content to the website. I'm going to be moving a lot of stuff also from other sites that I've started for a similar purpose. So there's going to be a pretty dramatic expansion of content in that regard. And then I'm going to get back to doing the speech science this month in speech science. So why not? It's what started it all.
And for next week's podcast, Lucas Stuber, you had the opportunity to speak with a soon-to-be SLP in Iraq?
I did. It was a fantastic conversation and really, really illuminating about you know, that part of the world and the diversity not only of our profession, but also the diversity just of how we as humans live. So it was very interesting.
And at home, please go to speechscience.org. You can check out this podcast, last week's interview with Mike Sciatos.
Yeah, which I real quickly want to say thank you so much to everyone who listened. We were blown away by the response. I think it was, what, 5 or 6 days? We already were over our bandwidth limit for the podcast server.
We have a high bandwidth limit. It's not just that.
Yeah, well, right. It's a high one. I mean, and I just looked today, and we're another several gigabytes over. So we've had to make some changes in how we host it, but it still works. And then we also for that provider, we were is Podomatic, right? We were the number two podcast in their training category. So that's pretty cool stuff.
So there you
can
go.
Also find our podcast on iTunes and what's the other place? Google Play.
Google Play. Yep.
Yeah, at home, please go to iTunes, rate us 5 stars. If you like us, drop us a note. You can email us also at contact@speechscience.org. Check out our website, speechscience.org. Gentlemen, it has been a true pleasure tonight.
Yeah, exactly.
Likewise.
Yeah, that was fun. And I don't even like you guys.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, you know what's not
a social filter.
A little pragmatic work maybe I should do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know, let me write you some goals.
For Lucas Stuper, Ivan Campo, Chandru Vital, my name is Matthew Hott for SpeechScience.org, the podcast. Our opening music today was Please Listen Carefully by Jazar. It's licensed under CC BY-SA. And our closing music tonight is Pinnacle by Fleslet, also licensed under CC BY 2.0. Good night, everybody.